From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. OU political scientist Paul Good joins me to talk about the ongoing situation in Ukraine. He's an expert on nationalism and ethnic politics in Russia and the former Soviet republics.
Any concessions that Yanukovych makes at this point to the opposition will be greeted with a great degree of distrust. And, of course, the opposition leaders, political leaders in Ukraine, have not been driving events, but they will be the people turned to resolve a constitutional crisis.
And later, Suzette Grelot talks with author Paul Bogard about his book, The End of Night.
8 of 10 kids born in the U.S. today will never live where they can see the Milky Way. So if we're going to give our kids that opportunity, we're going to have to make the effort on our own to go to those places.
Finding darkness in an age of artificial light. The news is next. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Paul Good, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've been paying attention this last couple of months, like about 3 months, to the situation in Ukraine. And then here this last week, things turned quite violent. And so we wanted to have you into the show and talk about this a little bit. To start with, we are getting a very specific narrative here in the West. We're hearing about the protesters, the government response. Is this the accurate narrative? What is actually going on in the ground that you've been able to learn about? And you know, maybe even talk a little bit about what the Russian narrative is in all this.
Well, there are competing narratives in the Western media as well as in the Russian media. To a large extent, those two media narratives don't have a lot with what is actually happening on the ground. The Western media is very captured by the notion that this is a choice between Ukraine leaning towards Russia or leaning towards the EU. It sort of fits within this Cold War trope that's been persistent for the last 20 years. The Russian media narrative is very much informed by the Russian government's perspective of what it sees happening in the post-Soviet space, particularly with reference to the Orange Revolution in 2004. The Orange Revolution, of course, was an attempt to restore fairness to Ukrainian elections, which brought Viktor Yushchenko to power. It was the putative villain in the Orange Revolution, Viktor Yanukovych, that is now today's president in Ukraine. And Russia has always viewed the Orange Revolution as an unconstitutional attempt to overthrow an existing legitimate government. Also, from Russia's perspective, too, what is happening in Ukraine is pretty much Putin's worst nightmare. This is absolutely what Putin wants to avoid. And so Ukraine's current crisis serves essentially as a cautionary tale that the Kremlin likes to tell Russians about: if you do not support the current regime, this is potentially what you risk if you support the opposition.
Now, can you foresee Russia getting more involved than they already are? Could we see troops on the ground in this sort of situation?
Realistically, it does not seem like it would be even remotely in Russia's interest. Now, the one case we have of Russia's military involvement beyond its borders since the collapse of the Soviet Union really has been the war with Georgia in 2008. The circumstances that provoked that war are not present right now. The one case which has been potentially contentious has been the situation in Crimea. Crimea is not like the rest of eastern Ukraine. Crimea is 90% Russian. It used to be part of Russia. It was gifted to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev back in the 1950s. And Crimea's parliament has periodically made statements opposed to what is happening on the Maidan and even requesting that Russia help to intervene. A high-placed Russian official has apparently claimed that if there was a violent civil war that broke out in Ukraine, that Russia might actually intervene on behalf of Crimea. But nothing that Putin has said, nothing that the government has officially said that is willing to have attributed, has even indicated that that would be remotely in Russia's interest. Okay. And quite frankly, I think from Russia's perspective, from a realpolitik perspective, Russia doesn't have to do anything to continue benefiting from the situation. Mm-hmm. Certainly intervening would damage Russia's reputation internationally as well as domestically, much more so than letting events play out as they are.
Well, you mentioned the Crimea, and we've been seeing a lot of photos from Kyiv. So it seems like everything is focused on Kyiv, but that's not the entire situation, right? This is a large country, and it's a much more complex situation.
That's right. And as you mentioned, the first wave of protests back in November were really focused just on the Maidan and Kyiv. The second wave of protests that followed the adoption of some rather harsh anti-protester laws in January spread well outside of Kyiv. So you had actually protesters taking control of regional administrative offices across western Ukraine as well as in parts of central Ukraine. We're seeing this happen once again, starting in Lvov and also moving towards central Ukraine, as now even members of Berkut, the elite special services forces that are used for anti-riot duties, are starting to defect over to the opposition sides, mayors disavowing their membership in the Party of Regions. And so this is definitely a national phenomenon. It is not so widespread in the eastern portions of Ukraine, which is the power base for the current regime, for Yanukovych's regime in Donetsk. But there are also not people out demonstrating on the streets in support of the regime either.
Where do you think we're going to head in this? Is this going to end relatively soon? Is this going to be long and drawn out? And what is the end point?
It definitely does not end soon. The violence may end soon, and one hopes that it will, obviously. But regardless, the point at which the regime has reached is clearly a point to no return insofar as any concessions that Yanukovych makes at this point to the opposition will be greeted with a great degree of distrust. They will require some sort of external mediation. There will be arguments over who should be the external mediators. The degree to which Russia will be involved will be contested. The degree to which the European Union will be involved will be contested. And, of course, the opposition itself, opposition leaders, political leaders in Ukraine have not been driving events, but they will be the people turned to resolve a constitutional crisis. They have different agendas once you get beyond the common platform of opposing Yanukovych. And accommodating those agendas is going to be extremely difficult.
Okay. Well, we will continue to watch this story. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions that you may have. Leave a comment in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or send us direct messages at Cruz226 and at Suzette Grelot. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, sitting in for Suzette Grelot. The beam from the top of the pyramid-shaped Luxor Las Vegas Hotel and Casino is one of the brightest single points of light on Earth. But just a short car ride away, a person can experience near-total darkness in the middle of the Nevada desert. Our guest, Paul Bogard, explores the role artificial light plays in our lives in his latest book, The End of Night. Paul Bogard, welcome to Worldviews.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So you've written the most interesting book, The End of Night. I'm really fascinated by this, because we don't spend a lot of time appreciating night and even really thinking about the fact that night doesn't even really exist anymore with all this artificial light. You're focusing on artificial light as the end of night. What motivated you to focus on that? Why? Why this subject?
I have always loved night. I think I'm one of those folks who really appreciates the way that, as I say it, the world slows down in speed and size at night. And I just feel like there's less noise and less people, less speed, all that kind of thing. And I feel like it's gives me a chance to breathe and to recuperate and refresh and all those things. And then you combine that with growing up in Minnesota, we had a cabin in the northern part of the state. And every summer for weeks at a time, we would go up there. And I just had that firsthand experience of a real night sky, for example, the Milky Way from one horizon to the next, and the woods so dark that you can't see your hands in front of your face and that kind of thing. And that sort of firsthand experience of night.
That's just such a great story of where these things come from, you know, your motivation and inspiration, I guess, thinking about you. You made me think about my childhood and my experience of night because, I mean, you mentioned, you know, that this is a calming time and it's a time when you slow down. There's less noise, although some places maybe there are more bugs and crickets and things that go off at night. But, you know, why is it that we have so much artificial light? Because I think a lot of people might think, well, I'm afraid of the dark. I'm afraid of night. We need light. Night because dark is scary, and yet you're kind of saying the opposite.
Well, for sure. And I'm always quick to say that I'm not here to talk about let's have no light. I'm a big fan of light at night. I think it's a wonderful miracle. It's we all like it. We're going to have it. What I'm really concerned about is how we're using it and the fact that we're using too much of it, and we're using it in ways that's harmful to us. It's robbing our view of the night sky. It's harming our physical body. I think it's impacting our spiritual and soulful selves. It's impacting the ecology. So for all these reasons, I just really want to draw our attention to the way that we're using this miracle of artificial light. And I do think that in general, the growth of light around us, of artificial light, has happened very rapidly. If you look back just maybe 50 years ago, this was a very different country, a much darker country. But it's also happened just slowly enough that it's hard to notice. And I'll give you a good example of that, which is gas stations and parking lots, which are so bright these days, are 10 times as bright as they were just 20 years ago, which isn't very long ago. And why is that? Well, lots of reasons, but certainly, as you mentioned, one reason is just that we're afraid of the dark. And I think that that fear of the dark is reflected in our use of artificial light, the way we try to push away darkness with artificial light. But again, I think that we can have artificial light at night. We can have all the light we need for safety and security and still use light in responsible, thoughtful ways that doesn't send light into the sky or into our eyes or into our neighbor's bedroom.
But this is clearly a universal thing, right? I mean, around the world, you look at these images, these wonderful images in your book of different parts of the world and the artificial light, the images from space of the light at night. I mean, this is something that's really kind of human nature, is that we want to light up our world at night. And perhaps there are reasons for productivity, to pack a lot of life into your life, into your 24 hours. But as you said, there are health consequences, the ecological consequences. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. The what they're finding with the human health consequences of artificial light at night are primarily three main things. The first is that it's disrupting our sleep and contributing to sleep disorders, which are tied now to every major disease that we're dealing with in Western civilization. Light at night is also confusing our circadian rhythms, those 24-hour internal rhythms that orchestrate all our body's functionings. And then finally, light at night is impeding the production of the hormone melatonin. And what folks have found is that a lack of melatonin in the bloodstream leads to an increased risk of developing breast cancer or prostate cancer. So some really serious issues when it comes to the effect of light at night on human health. And then when you think about life on Earth in general, which including human beings have evolved with bright days. We need light. There's no doubt about that. But also with dark nights. And we really need darkness for our physical, spiritual, and soulful health. In the last 50 years or so, we've flooded the night with this artificial light. And we and other life on Earth has had no time to evolve to adjust to that. And so you have, for example, when it comes to species at night, we have so many nocturnal species, so many crepuscular species, species that rely on dawn and dusk for all their living. And when we flood their habitat with light at night, we are essentially the bulldozer of the night, is that what I call artificial light at night. It just destroys this habitat. So it has, light at night has real implications for human health, but really for all life on Earth.
And this doesn't even get into the financial and environmental consequences, right? I mean, the cost of lighting up our night and the energy that's required.
That's really true. I mean, when you see the photographs of the Earth from space, they're really quite beautiful and stunning photographs, but they're also photographs of waste. You're seeing lights that are just shining right up into the sky in all directions, into our eyes, into our neighbors' bedrooms. And that's wasted energy. It's wasted money. We estimated the U.S. wastes about $10 billion a year just on light, outdoor light that's not doing us any good. And I think what you're going to see, and in some ways this is a hopeful sign, is that as we begin to, say, plug in our cars at night, as our energy use changes, you're going to see, I think, electricity priced differently. And then I think people are going to start to think twice about all the electricity that they're wasting at night with these lights that we're using so much more light than we need to.
You're listening to Suzette Grelot speaking with author and creative writing professor Paul Bogard, who's written two environmental nonfiction books about night, darkness, and light pollution. More of their conversation after a break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, filling in for Suzette Grelot. You're listening to her discussion with author Paul Bogard, who also teaches creative writing at James Madison University. They're talking about his book, The End of Night, Searching for Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light.
So I thought it was interesting the connecting your work with some of the recent research that I just happened to be reading one day. I think it was in the New York Times about the disruptive nature of light in terms of our sleep, and that we actually used to have first and second sleep, mm-hmm. right? And that we used to actually have a break in our sleeping patterns, and we would have, you know, a time when we would get through a good, you know, REM, and then we would come awake, and then we would get up and socialize and do things, read, exactly. whatever, right. and then, you know, family time, and then you would have a second sleep or whatever, and that light has changed the way in which we now say we have to get 8 hours of sleep, or we have to, you know, most of us don't, but yeah. but it's really changed the way we live in so many ways, and yet there are so many reasons to do it. I mean, so the skeptic out there that says, "What are you talking about?" You know, we need to have, you know, light is a right. You know, we need to have light at all times of the day in order to be safe or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't have light at night. I'm just saying that we should use light at night responsibly, thoughtfully, you know, with thinking about our neighbor. We have what's called one of the aspects of light pollution that we deal with quite a bit is something called light trespass, which is light from one property that bleeds over to another property. And so, you know, I sometimes ask folks to think about the fact that, yeah, it's okay if you want to light up your house 24/7, that's one thing. But what happens is that when you light up your house 24/7, you're also probably lighting up your neighbor's house and the sky and the streets, everybody driving by. You know, we're not good at keeping our light on our property. And so what we do affects everyone around us. Those what we call security lights or barn lights or pole lights that all across the country are out shining in the middle of the country night and lighting not just that one farm or that one ranch, but for miles and miles around. And if your neighbors aren't that excited about it, they don't really have any recourse at this point. We haven't become responsible, I guess, with our use of light at night.
So like any other type of externality, right, there are costs to mm-hmm. your personal use of light. So secondhand smoke, right, or pollution of any kind, right? I mean, we're talking here about light pollution. Is this what more or less you're suggesting?
Absolutely. And, you know, a number of the folks that I talk to who are actively working in this field say that 20 or 25 years ago, they were giving talks to people who had never heard the words light and pollution together. And they feel good about the fact that now a lot of people have at least heard of the concept of light pollution. But I talk to people all the time who maybe they've heard that term, but they are so used to the way that we're using light. And we've grown up, many of us, just surrounded by light that we don't see it. And I sometimes apologize to people because I say, once I point it out to you, you're going to start seeing it everywhere.
I'm going to see lights from now exactly, on. Yeah. Well, so let's say if you were to go search for darkness, mm-hmm. where would you go? Where in the world can you find significant darkness?
Well, I would say that, you know, in many cases, you can find it anywhere in some senses. You certainly are areas around the world that still have that natural primordial darkness that the earth has always had. So I'm talking about out in the ocean, for example, or in the Amazon, in the outback of Australia,
in the desert.
Sure, exactly. But what I was really concerned with in the book was the night and the darkness that most of us experience or could experience. So I focused my journey in the lower 48 and in Western Europe, and the places that I found, if you're really interested in darkness in the lower 48, go west and go out to especially the national parks of the Southwest. I found just wonderful darkness. And I also found the National Park Service now with a dedicated night sky team that's going around and measuring the levels of darkness, and a park service that is dedicated itself to preserving the resource of darkness. They see a darkness as an actual resource that they're trying to protect, and have really made the parks a place where Americans can come to from wherever they live and experience a real night, and then take that experience back to the cities and suburbs where they live and talk about things like safety and security and maybe having a lighting ordinance in their town that reduces some of this pollution.
So I think looking at the maps in your book, I noticed that Greece is actually a place where you might actually find quite a bit of darkness. If you're going to look at Europe as a place where you can find darkness, the image seemed to be, you know, Greece was the place to go. Is that? And I wonder if there's a connection here between light and development. you know, the fact that you do see, you know, in heavily developed parts of the world, not that, you know, Greece isn't, but, you know, it's a part of Europe that is perhaps in some ways developed in a different way.
Sure, absolutely. And when you look at that image of the world at night and you see it all lit up, you can definitely tell the areas that are developed and the areas that aren't developed. It's a really revealing image in many respects. Yeah, artificial light, that is electric light and increasingly electronic light, tends to follow development. And wherever we go, we bring our lights with us. What we're hoping, I guess, is that we'll begin to see progress not only just with light, but true progress being thoughtful and responsible lighting. And so the places that are truly developed will actually look a little less bright from those images from space.
So just one last thing I have to ask, because I think it's so interesting that you pointed out darkness as a resource. I mean, it indicating that like light, it's something that we consume and that we should consume. I guess what you're saying, that we should consume more darkness and less light. Mm-hmm. So give us some advice. How should we experience the dark? What would you suggest?
I love the idea of becoming aware of the value of darkness and beginning to see all the wasted light around us, and then doing whatever you can to get out to a local area that's a little bit darker, even if it's just a city park or at the edge of town or something like that, or taking a longer trip to a truly dark place and beginning to experience firsthand, again, that darkness that has always been an experience of being a human being. And if you have kids, to take kids with you, to introduce them to that part of being alive, and begin to pass on that heritage of experiencing real darkness and real night. We live in a country now where the estimates are that 8 of 10 kids born in the U.S. today will never live where they can see the Milky Way. So if we're going to give our kids that opportunity, we're going to have to make the effort on our own to go to those places. And then within your own house, I would say, too, that one of the most effective things you can do is to sleep in the dark. That's when I talk to the researchers, they all say, we don't know exactly what's happening. We can't exactly tell you what's going to happen to your body if you're exposed to light, but we can tell you that if it's possible, sleep in the dark.
Such a fascinating topic. Paul, thank you so much for being with us, and I'm sure that many of us will see light in a very different way from now on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with author and James Madison University creative writing professor Paul Bogard. You can read an excerpt of his book, The End of Night, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies through a collaborative partnership with KGOU. Nick Aguilera prepared this episode's web post online, Hillary Gibson conducted the research for this interview, and the show is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Suzette Gerlot and Paul Good, I'm Rebecca Cruz.